evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Now, usually we tell you that the phone lines are open and our weekly conversations include you. Tonight, something to sit back and listen to and hopefully enjoy. I'll tell you why in just a minute. Now, you would think that countries with democracy and open market economies in common might work closely together. But although both Japan and South Korea are U.S. allies, how much they work together often splits along issues of national identity. That has prompted two scholars to look at the wedge issues among all three countries and what co-authors Brad Glosserman and Scott Snyder say should be done about them for the mutual benefit of all. Their book, The Japan-South Korea Identity Clash, East Asian Security and the United States, was released in May, and on the day of its release, we talked with Brad Glosserman on the conversation about what he and Scott Snyder believe is the way forward. It's what they call the grand bargain. Now, tonight, we're going to take up that discussion again, but to make this conversation possible, we've had to record it, so that's why the phone lines are unavailable. In the studio with me in Honolulu is Brad Glosserman. He's the executive director of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu, an independent program of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. And on the phone with us from D.C. is Scott Snyder. He is a senior fellow for Korea Studies and the director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He writes regularly on issues in U.S.-Korea relations and Northeast Asian politics and security for CFR's Asia Unbound blog and for Forbes.com. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us back.
Well, there was so much more, Brad, that we wanted to talk about. But, of course, with a smaller conversation, there was just a few minutes for us to be able to do that on the day of the book's release. And other folks had asked questions, and there seemed to be so much more that we should be talking about. So very much appreciate the fact that you and you too, Scott Snyder, as you're coming to us from D.C. on this phone line, are able to give us an hour to sit down and talk more fully about it. When we began to talk about this, Brad, when you were here in May, part of the discussion was that, you know, one would think intuitively that countries that had a lot of things in common might find ways of bonding together. But when you talk about these three countries, the U.S., Korea, and Japan, that's very often those issues that divide them aren't in the issues of the group's identity as a group, but those national identity issues take precedence. Why?
Well, that's actually a very good question, because for much of the post-war era, the post-World War II era, you saw the United States, Japan, and Korea working together quite well. They had a common enemy, and most people that work on these issues and study have suggested it's precisely this identification of a common enemy is what binds countries together. It's the glue. And until the end of the Cold War, 1991, you seem to see those three pretty much walking in sync, marching together, cooperating in powerful ways, and really, if you will, sublimating these issues that seem to have emerged since then in ways that have pushed them apart. And so the question that really animated the study that got Scott and I started was, why is it, given what should be this concordance of views, that these three countries seem to be having such difficulties? Why is it that in theory, as you've noted, they've got similar values and similar interests and similar geographic positioning? Why is it that they don't see the world the same way sufficiently to motivate them to work together to combat the threat posed by North Korea or the threat that we seem to be seeing coming from China?
Scott Snyder, what are those issues that push us apart?
Well, most of the issues that pushed Japan and South Korea apart, we decided to use identity as the way of getting at these issues, because we wanted to avail ourselves of the opportunity to look at self-assessments through public opinion surveys conducted in Japan and in South Korea, respectively, about perceptions of self and other. And the fact that South Korea has emerged as a democracy really, you know, helped us to be able to do that. But I think that what it really comes down to is that these two countries, by virtue of the history of relations between the two, and in particular the Japanese colonial period, where Korea lost its nationhood to Japan. You know, essentially emerging from that, South Korea has viewed its own national identity really in opposition to Japan. And there are two national holidays per year that provide opportunities for South Korea to reflect on the bad things that occurred during the colonial period. On the other hand, in Japan, there's definitely, I think, a sense of sensitivity about the relationship with Korea that is there, I think, under the surface. I think has the sense of kind of difficulty in terms of trying to figure out how to deal with South Korea, I think, has been magnified by a sense of uncertainty that comes from the fact that the Japanese economy has been stagnant for a period of time, and the Japanese find themselves in a situation where, in certain areas, South Korea has kind of caught up, and you know that kind of goes against the historic view that Japanese might have had of South Korea as a follower.
With Japan and with South Korea, as you've just mentioned, why each has a bit of a fisheye toward the other in some ways. What about its view of the United States, each country's view of the United States, given the fact that we have relationships with both countries, but they're a little bit different? And that might perhaps change the way each regards the United States, does it?
I think that what we see there is the post-Korean War opportunity to set up parallel alliances with Japan and South Korea, respectively. It did well at keeping the peace, but there were definitely some obstacles to trying to, for the U.S., to try to pull South Korea and Japan together. The United States, at various times during the Cold War, as Brad suggested, you know, has been able to kind of bring Japan and South Korea to a certain degree. But essentially, the relationships have been running in parallel with each other for a long period of time. There are issues that have enabled greater cooperation, most notably the emerging threat of North Korea, and I think more recently the U.S. rebalancing strategy creates a rationale for the U.S. to want to see Japan and South Korea work together. But I think from the perspective of the U.S., the thing that is really striking is that these alliance relationships have been running in parallel with each other, and yet in many cases, they're covering exactly the same ground and are framed by the same rationales. In some respects, it seems like a lot of duplicative effort to run parallel mm-hmm. bilateral alliances rather than to have everybody working together under the same tent.
All right, I want to get Brad in on this part of the conversation, too. They're running parallel streams. Why not intertwined?
Well, we're trying to. That would be the objective. I think it's been a goal. But there have been, I think, practical reasons why that hasn't happened. Let me back up a little bit, though, and start. An original or previous version of this this project, you know, when we tried to understand the national identity in each country, we decided that the Japanese were confused about who they were in the world, and the South Koreans were confident. So we called it, I think, confusion and confidence, contrasting views of national identity. And the United States, I think, was in many ways a key component of the way that the two countries interacted. Number one, the Japanese, of course, have legal constraints in the form of their constitution, which prevents them from taking joint, or what they call the exercise of the right of collective self-defense. And so the nature of the United States-Japan security relationship is very much unique, even though it's limited in important respects. But both countries would look to the United States, as you will, and sort of would look at the other out of its eye. So when the Americans, for example, have historically referred to the relationship with Japan as the cornerstone of U.S. presence in Asia, and then a few years ago we started referring to our relationship with South Korea as the linchpin, and you had security analysts and officials in each country going back and forth saying, well, can you have more than one linchpin? Which is more important, a linchpin or a cornerstone? And that sort of element of insecurity, if you will, suggested that each was looking at the other country and its relationship with Washington as something of a benchmark. And so the United States was very much in the middle. And while attempting to bring the two countries together in pursuit of parallel purposes, at the same time, because of their historical grievances, you often had them turning to Washington and asking them to take sides. And American policymakers, I think, were smart enough to recognize that that was a dead end. You certainly didn't want to be seen as favoring one ally over another. Unfortunately, these are tough and contentious issues, and it was difficult to stay neutral. And one of the things I think that is so important about our study that frankly has not really gotten the attention it deserves is precisely the degree to which we call on the United States to sort of be a little less neutral, not so much in taking sides, but at least rolling up its sleeves and becoming more actively involved in attempts to bring the three countries together and to step away from the historical perspective, which was, you know, it's really up to Tokyo and Seoul to make their relationship work, and we're more of a bystander. I think, to go to your question, that we're living in a world where our financial resources are limited, where the nature of the threats are very different, where the capacities and capabilities of our allies are more expansive, and therefore we need to think differently about how we engage our partners and our allies. And as Scott said, the rebalance is a key part of that. And one of the key elements of that is precisely networking, if we will, what have been called the spokes in what has been the hub and spokes model of U.S. relations with allies. So bring Korea and Japan, which have typically interacted through the United States on security matters, to interact with themselves, similarly with Australia, similarly with the Philippines or Thailand or other allies and other partners in the region too.
In addition to being the convener, does the U.S. also have to in some way take responsibility for all of this history? I mean, not come at it in a vacuum, but bring in its own part.
All of it, no. A great deal of it, yes. The argument that we make is, and this is extremely contentious, by the way, is that the United States fingerprints are on many, most, almost all of the important developments in the 20th century in Asia. You can go all the way back to the settlement of the Portsmouth Treaty in the first decade of the 20th century. The U.S. has played a key role, and consequently, we need to acknowledge that role, and from there, I think, move forward.
Scott, I think I heard you try to jump in on that, too.
Oh, 1905. I just wanted to give the date of the Portsmouth Treaty. I think that the U.S. has been involved, and also the U.S. can't really take an approach toward Japan and South Korea that fails to acknowledge the historical relationship that has existed between the two countries. And so I think that our identity framework provides a very useful way for U.S. policymakers to be able to make sure that they've got that factored in as the United States tries to facilitate and create what I would call an enabling environment for South Korea and Japan to stabilize their relationship with each other.
As you have looked at this as being an identity clash between Japan and South Korea, what is the identity of the United States in all of this?
That's a good question. I mean, historically, I think that it would be categorized as security guarantor. But also, we asked some questions about shared values in a survey that we conducted at one point. That did show that Japan and South Korea respectively do identify with aspects of American democratic values in ways that I think, you know, give traction to the idea that that there's a basis for a close relationship. And in fact, increasingly, the alliances themselves have been framed as alliances that encompass shared values based on like-mindedness with both Japan and South Korea.
Is that enough, Brad Glosserman, to be able to approach each other in a more fulsome way than we have in past? In other words, does one country really see those same shared values in the other, even if it doesn't want to maybe publicly acknowledge it?
Is it enough? No. I would say it is a necessary and probably an unlikely to be sufficient condition. And the other way to look at it is precisely the reverse angle on this, which is the argument that animates much of what's behind Scott's and my thinking is that as we look at the world, we believe in the predominant paradigm in the foreign policy and security world is realism, which is you look around, you see the threats that you face, and that if you agree on the threat, that should be sufficient to bring countries together for collective action. The problem that we face in Northeast Asia right now, very simply, is that Japan, South Korea have at various times in the United States been threatened by North Korea to be turned into a sea of fire. That they look at China and they see a country that in theory at times seeks to rewrite the rules of engagement, to change the international order, to change, if you will, the structure of power within in the region. And despite that, nevertheless, we don't see that to be a sufficient motivator to get them to overcome historical issues, precisely these problems that they faced in the past. And yet, you know, during the Cold War, we didn't have these problems. So what has emerged and why doesn't the threat serve as a glue? And Scott and I, in examining this, came to the conclusion that it is precisely because the nature of who these countries are, how these countries define who they are, and the nature of creating identity, by the way, is a really fascinating one too, because identities are created. They don't just exist. That the nature of creating that is such that it helps you define what's important to you, what your interests are, and therefore the way that the Chinese or the Japanese and the South Koreans look at themselves focus them more on the things that divide them rather than the things that would unite them over China. So our study becomes an attempt to suggest why is that? And if that is the case, how is it that we can use this reality for what we would consider to be the pursuit of American interests? In other words, the arguments that we ultimately make are, in our conclusion and our recommendations are, if this is identity, how can we use identity for positive ends rather than the negative ones that seem to kind of be dominating the discussions today?
As all of this has been playing out, we've watched the world change a great deal. You mentioned a little earlier in our conversation that we're still myopically trained on that pivot to Asia, but we're also watching China change greatly. I mean, a middle class that's been emerging over the last few years that wants more, that is after the same kind of, in many ways, you know, values or ideals that Americans have enjoyed for a very long time, particularly with regard to consumerism. With all of these changes, and you talk about looking at a potential common threat. Clearly, China is a common threat, but does that not mean that these countries are looking at each other more as potential allies with each other and moving a little closer to each other? Or is it just something that still is in development with looking at China?
Well, China is an interesting issue. And at one point in the study, Scott and I looked at conceptions of identity, but that proved to be, I think, a humongous task. And we put it aside until someone wants to give us money to do it again. And even then, I'm not sure that either of us quite has the stamina for that. But I think, you know, China is a combination of both threat or, if you will, a problem and prospect. It is an opportunity and potentially a threat. Our relationships, ours as the United States, every country in the world's relationship with China is a hybrid. And at times, the level of competition or cooperation will go up and down, and periodically it may even boil over into actual conflict. So China poses – and it goes again to these questions, I think, of who these countries think of themselves. So one of the questions that Scott and I asked was, do you identify more with the United States or with China? Do you see your values as being closer to those of China or that of the U.S.? And in most cases, it tends to be towards the United States. But still, there are moments when, for example, the Confucian identity in South Korea seems to predominate. And consequently, you know, there are tactical considerations that drive these relationships. So, for example, today, South Korea is really trying to create a relationship with North Korea. And the feeling is that to effectively do that, you have to have a good relationship with China. But then the question becomes, can China deliver Or when you move beyond that tactical concern, nevertheless, does China somehow present values and present itself to the region and the world in ways that are fundamentally opposed to South Korean values? And again, up and down it changes at times.
As that is changing, Scott, doesn't that also change the way in which the United States also needs to deal with South Korea and Japan?
Yes, certainly. I think that this is kind of a moving target. And I think that maybe the best way in which to illustrate that is to, or at least the best way to illustrate some of the potential challenges is to drill down on the South Korean and Japanese respective views of China. And I think that what we see there is that Japan, broadly speaking, is probably more inclined at this stage, as Brad, I think, was hinting at, to balance against China's rise, whereas South Korea is more interested in pursuing a relationship that remains, at least on the surface, cooperative. And so I think that all of these relationships, you know, in the end, the U.S.-China relationship is going to provide a kind of broad context for that we face in terms of managing. And certainly that's the strategic challenge, is the challenge of keeping the U.S.-China relationship on a stable footing. But embedded in that strategic challenge is this specific problem of, can the U.S. Keep its allies together in harness with each other and working with each other in ways that can actually help all the parties more effectively in terms of managing their relations with China?
Brad, you wanted to chime in on this too.
As we look at what's unfolding right now in East Asia, we're seeing a number of challenges, a number of actions by China that we consider, we, the United States, Japan, South Korea, and the conversations that I've had with them in the last, or South Koreans that I've had in the last couple of weeks, and I know Scott has as well, where many nations see Chinese behavior as being destabilizing and damaging to what we call the international order. You know, and what we're talking primarily about here is the South China Sea. And so, again, and most people, there's virtual unanimity that the best way to really get China's attention and to get them to stop doing these things would be to speak with one voice regarding the nature of Chinese behavior and to condemn it universally. And the problem that we face, of course, is that if in fact that presumes that Tokyo and Seoul are marching in lockstep with Washington in regard to the views of China, what China is doing and why, and that the nature of and keeping China, sending China that message is the most important thing we can do. And again, I think what Scott and I kind of conclude from this analysis is precisely that there are other factors, that the assumption that just because we're an ally of South Korea, that it will then join us in condemning Beijing's behavior is a dangerous one for both, again, tactical reasons, as well as I think a sense perhaps that South Koreans can in some ways identify with what Chinese behavior is as a function of its identity. One component of this, which we don't get into in a great deal, which is, I think, interesting, is there is, at periodic times, some resentment of the United States. And so the natural assumption among Americans that we're always right and our allies are always on board is one that needs to be challenged. And the South Koreans have periodic spikes of anti-American behavior. And I'm not suggesting that's what's motivating this, but there is a periodic resentment that occurs in countries around the world of the United States. And I think that one can easily extrapolate from the data that the Chinese, their resentment of American behavior might be shared at some level, some very, very basic level, and I wouldn't go too far with this, by South Koreans and perhaps even some Japanese. And so, again, that becomes an identity factor. It's the nature of how these societies think about who they are, what matters to them, the values, the relationships that are important as a function of national identity. And therefore, that this creates a new level of or a new way to approach these problems and to think about our relationships.
Overlay what you've just said with the identity of South Korea versus the identity of North Korea. and some of the movement that we've been seeing, including by some Americans, to try to unify them?
Well, you know, and this is really an interesting question. And Scott, of course, is one of the leading authorities on this in the U.S. and the worldwide. So I'll just I'm going to speak for a second to let him prepare some really intelligent remarks. You're up there next, Scott. And, you know, historically, South Koreans saw North Korea as part of the same country. The folks that were probably my generation and older, parents and grandparents, only really conceived of one Korean people. And so that was an integral component of South Korean identity. Today, young people, I would say people under the ages of 40, are one that grew up knowing always two Koreas. And consequently, that sense of a single Korean identity has diminished significantly. That's a key element of the book. And so whereas this the driving, the impetus for unification that's so animated, and the hatred in many cases of the North Korean regime that so animated older South Koreans has diminished substantially. And, you know, I sort of facetiously say now many young Koreans, South Koreans, look at North Korea as the crazy ant in the attic, just sort of leave them alone. And so there isn't – the Korean identity has evolved significantly. And so how South Koreans engage North Korea, on what grounds, and how the role that the United States and extension Japan plays in that process of accommodation, reconciliation, unification is really a key issue.
Scott, I want to ask you about what Brad just mentioned in terms of the view of the of North Korea as being the crazy in the attic. That crazy in the attic may be so, but that crazy is also dangerous.
It's and I think it's actually the perception of persistent security threat that has been one of the most powerful arguments against a kind of brotherhood identity between South and North Korea, as South Koreans look at the fact that North Korea continues to try to expand its capabilities and essentially continue the longstanding legitimacy competition that has existed between the two Koreas since the Korean War. That has actually tilted, I think, South Korean public opinion toward the idea that there is a threat that needs to be overcome. Having said that, I think there still is a significant plurality within South Korea that wants to hold on to the idea of brotherhood between North and South Korea, and this is a consistent influence, I think, in terms that moderates South Korean politics and makes it necessary for South Korean political leaders to continue to reach out diplomatically to North Korea, even when it looks like they're getting dissed or slapped in the face. But I think the other point that is relevant here that I just want to add in is that back in the 1970s, the two Koreas in many respects were two sides of the same coin, although they had differing ideologies. They're both essentially authoritarian states. But the real divergence that I think has had a big impact on identity longer term on the peninsula is really related to South Korea's decision to democratize and to embrace economic interdependence while North Korea remains isolated. And I think that that has had a major effect in terms of how South Koreans are viewing North Korea and how they're viewing the world. And it actually means that over the course of the past 15 years, we've seen, I think, the two Koreas continuing to grow farther apart from each other.
Do South Koreans fear North Koreans as much as we in the United States believe they do?
Well, that's the question that often comes up, because when you walk the streets of Seoul, even at times of apparent crisis between the two Koreas, it seems like the South Korean public has just taken on board the threat. You know, it's so much, it's been a part of their life for such a long period of time. But if you look at the way the government is responding to the idea of North Korea as a nuclear state, with South Korea not competing in that sphere, I think it's pretty clear that there is a core in South Korea that feels that this is a very serious threat and that it's got to be dealt with as part of the inter-Korean relationship first before anything else.
Brad, you had something to say about this too.
And I think this takes us really to the heart of the book. What as an American, and I think whether you're an expert or not, you look at North Korea and you see its behavior as belligerent, as threatening. And by the way, we use the word crazy and irrational, I think, loosely. These guys are – you have to give the North Koreans credit for playing a great hand – a poor hand very, very well. I think they've proven historically to be really shrewd. But we look at them and we think that they are this incredible threat, you know, literally threatening to use nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction against South Korea, Japan, against the United States at various times. And you would think, okay, in this environment, you've got Korea and Japan, or South Korea and Japan, similar countries in so many different ways. Why aren't they just cooperating on every possible level to address and combat the North Korean threat? And yet, And on a certain rhetorical level, you see parallels. But when it really comes down to the question of genuinely working together to address what the North Koreans are doing, to keep them in a box and perhaps roll back some of their most threatening programs, that's not happening. And that's what really animates this study. And Scott and I attend, as you can imagine, a number of discussions and conferences. And in the last ones that we were at in New York a few weeks ago, for example, or in Washington a week ago, you have South Koreans essentially – almost looking at Japan as a greater threat to them than North Korea. And that's, you know, the opinion polls show that when you ask them, the number one threat to South Koreans is North Korea. But Japan tends to be fairly close. It's certainly number two, in some cases number three, up and down depending on I think, news of the day. But it's remarkable that from a U.S. perspective, that rather than pushing together, they are more focused on each other, at least South Korea is. And the only way we can sort of explain that, I think, in a compelling way is by suggesting that there are divergent senses of identity. And that's, again, that's what's driving this. And it's just the fact that you have so many South Koreans saying, no matter what North Korea does, it's more important that you Japanese keep your distance from our shores because of historical issues, et cetera, than it is that you present even more effective fighting force against North Korea is in some cases quite stunning.
It almost sounds as if it's insurmountable, and yet you're calling for them to in some way, work through this and find ways beyond it.
The largest objection we get to what we propose is that it's politically impossible, and I think that's not a bad place to be, because politics is the art of the possible, and we've seen some bold moments. The circumstances can be painted in a very dark fashion. We take some solace, number one, from a period in 1998 and 1999 when the president and president of South Korea and the prime minister of Japan, in fact, signed a forward-looking agreement that's in many, many ways really sublimated these issues and actually did a great deal of what we're talking about. It subsequently dissolved primarily because of domestic political pressures in both countries. But we also see among the opinion data a concern in both countries about the nature of the relationship, a recognition that this is not good, a recognition that it needs to be fixed, and a desire to do so. And so using that as a starting point allows us to come up with, as the book does, two suggestions. One, which is a kind of what we call the lowest common denominator approach, which we consider the least that the three countries can do, or the grand bargain that we propose, which really more than anything else just requires political courage among the three leaderships. And yes, it's hard. Courage is always hard. And leadership is a word that we don't associate with much top political officials these days. But there are enough instances to demonstrate that it's possible and not a pipe dream.
Scott, talk a little bit about that grand bargain. That for especially, well, all for all three countries is going to be a difficult thing to swallow, because you're asking them each to take a great deal of responsibility for the past and for the ability to change their view of the other.
That's correct. We're definitely trying to outline steps that require political leadership and require political courage and really require statesmanship among all the leaders to take a historic step and to essentially try to bring public opinion in the respective countries along with them. And so I don't know if our solution is going to necessarily prove to be politically feasible, but we at least wanted to provide a sort of roadmap for how it might be possible to get out of this kind of cycle of stabilization and rupture between Japan and South Korea.
So let's talk about that roadmap just a little bit, too, because I know you live and breathe it, so does Brad. But for somebody just thinking, well, what does that look like? How do you start this monumental thing that looks like it truly is impossible? What happens first?
So our objective is to try to have the leaders in Japan and South Korea reframe their conceptions of national identity so that they are shared rather than in opposition to each other. And we believe that the United States has a catalytic role to play in helping the Japanese and South Korean leaders to do that. So essentially what we called for was for the U.S. president to acknowledge the U.S. Historical role in Asia post-World War II, and you know, including acknowledging the dropping of the atomic bomb. And in turn, our hope is that that acknowledgement would engender a response, first of all, from the Japanese Prime Minister, that such an acknowledgement would enable the Prime Minister to acknowledge some of the more sordid aspects of Japan's period of colonial aggression towards South Korea. You know, the visible manifestation of that that gets the most focus today is related to the comfort women issue, the issue of Korean sex slaves who were impressed to service to for the by the Japanese military, and then by acknowledging and making a moral gesture by offering compensation to the women who are still alive, Japan could take a step forward. And then also we suggest that you know, the other issue that stands out in the public opinion polling, especially on the South Korean side, is this island dispute between Japan and South Korea that for South Koreans has become a visible symbol and manifestation of colonial aggression. The Tokto Takeshima Island was the first island that that Japan took in advance of annexing South Korea. And so symbolically, if the Japanese Prime Minister were to renounce that claim, I think that that would provide a real test of whether or not South Korean grievance is satiable, can be whether or not it can be satisfied. And then the South Korean president has to lead the South Korean people in some respects, this could be the hardest part, in actually affirming reconciliation and providing forgiveness and in actually being willing to give up the long-held grievance against Japan, which we have identified actually as a component of South Korean national identity. In order to move past it and establish a shared sense of friendship between Japan and South Korea going forward. And we suggest that that should be marked on the calendars of the two countries as a day that they can commemorate and celebrate together.
Brad Glosserman, pick up on that.
That's the big bargain, and it does require some real courage, and this is the one that's gotten a lot of people gulping when we've suggested it to them. As part of that last national reconciliation holiday that Scott mentioned, we also call for this treaty that says the two countries agree that they will never ever resolve their disputes by anything other than diplomacy, that they will give up war, you know, a no-force clause, that Japan recognizes South Korean should unify the country, the Korean Peninsula under Seoul. The South Koreans would acknowledge Japan has a security role, which, to us, doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is. We would call for this creation of this shared celebration. That becomes, if you will, the big bargain. And to start, which your previous question, is that there are little things that, at a minimum, we absolutely should be doing and sadly aren't. And those would be, for example, that the three leaders of the President of the United States, the President of South Korea, the Prime Minister of Japan, every time that they're in the same postal code should be meeting together, sending a visible signal that they are cooperating, that they are working together for shared ends. So, for example, at the Hague Nuclear Security Summit in a year ago, that happen. We should be doing it at the United Nations General Assembly. We should be doing it at APEC meetings. We should be doing it at G20 meetings. Every time the three leaders are in the same venue, they should be having a sidebar where they're sending the signal of cooperation. Similarly, their foreign minister should be doing it. Their secretaries of defense or ministers of defense should be doing that. Throughout the bureaucracy, we need to have at the highest and lowest levels this cooperation. The United States, similarly, I think, even without – and we're not saying the U.S. should take sides. But one of the things that the U.S. could certainly do is, as we say, hold each country's feet to the fire. In other words, when they've made promises to the other, that both the United States – not demands, that's too hard, but I think nevertheless pushes, urges, makes sure that the countries know that these are commitments that they've made. And equally significantly, when one country does something good for the other, is just that it acts as a megaphone. There have been a number of gestures in the last few years where a Japanese leader has actually done something quite conciliatory and very positive to South Korea that has received practically no attention there. And that is, again, part of this because it goes so much against the national narrative of the Japan as being an enemy. And consequently, the Americans should be able to say, you know, they just returned these artifacts that you've complained about for years. You should give them a little bit of credit for that. And so the United States can act as both a megaphone, if you will, and a mirror in terms of making sure that both countries are treating the other, I think, with the respect and certainly the credit that it deserves.
You're also asking them, in a way, though, to be a mediator and to sit there and really let each tell its tale and show each what the other is doing in an impartial way. Can the United States do that without feeling somewhat threatened by having a greater and stronger relationship between South Korea and Japan?
The United States is very concerned about being forced to take sides. And I think most of the attention in the book to date has focused on what is asked of Japan and Korea. And primarily that's because I think that's for whom the audiences are these issues are most important. But I think some of the most controversial views really pertain to precisely to that of the United States and the degree to which we are prepared both to acknowledge the role that we've played historically because we want to keep a distance. So we like to think we're in many ways not guilty or not even engaged or involved in these issues, but also because we are afraid that we'll be seen as taking sides. We argue about the verb. Is it mediating? Is it facilitating? We're certainly facilitating, and we're doing that now. But I do think we should be neutral to the degree that we can be, and facts are always contested. But I do think that the Americans can present opportunities where exchanges take place, where there is the obligation to look at a situation through the other's eyes. And I don't think that the United – at the same time, let's be very clear. The U.S. has interests in this. For us to be distant, for us to pretend that somehow this isn't our problem, regardless of the historical component, that's just not true. We have a stake in these outcomes, and we should be doing whatever we can to try to at least create outcomes that are in the U.S. interest. And then I would hope – in ways that actually advance the South Korean and Japanese interests as well. Mind you, this is a very controversial view and one which Scott and I argued about a great deal in the drafting and the writing of the book.
All right, Scott, come back in here a little bit. As Brad just mentioned that you had some disagreements over this. What about what Brad just said do you disagree with?
Well, I think that I like to think of the U.S. role as that of facilitator, almost more like the presider at a wedding. If we're a mediator, we get ourselves directly involved. But ultimately, we need the buy-in, and we need to respect the agency of South Korea and Japan because it is their bilateral relationship. But there's much that the U.S. can do in order to shape a facilitative environment for stabilization and reconciliation in the relationship. So I agree with all of the things that Brad was saying about the U.S. interest in doing this. I particularly agree with the perceived danger on the part of the U.S. of becoming the object of a kind of alliance envy competition between Japan and South Korea, where both Japan and South Korea try to prove and show that they are closer to the United States than the other is. That's clearly negative and not in U.S. interest to be put in that kind of position. The way of moderating that is really to facilitate and to create the right environment. You know, if there's anything that the U.S. ought to be able to do related to its strategic position in Asia in the context of this U.S. rebalance, it should be to create a positive relationship between Japan and South Korea, because they're both allies of ours. We have the greatest leverage with them. We can't control what other parties in the region might do, but we certainly should be able to facilitate reconciliation between Japan and South Korea.
As the U.S. attempts to do that, should they attempt to do that, is there the idea, though, that, somehow it will be unavoidable that one or the other country, either South Korea or Japan, will see or misperceive that the U.S. is somehow taking sides? I mean, does that really become unavoidable when you're in that facilitation mode?
So I think that what we talked about this a little bit earlier when Brad was talking about Cornerstone and Linchpin.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to see the United States come out and very clearly state that the U.S.-Japan alliance and the U.S.-ROK alliance are both load-bearing beams that are the foundation of our security strategy in East Asia. In other words, we need to link them together. And likewise, essentially what we're proposing when we talk about a reframing of identity in Japan and South Korea, respectively, it's really about Japan stopping treating South Korea as other in their own domestic politics, and for South Korea to stop treating Japan as other in its domestic politics, and essentially to for both sides to recognize that the other country actually has a stake, and that the two countries' security interests are in fact bound with each other in ways that make it foolish to allow domestic politics to supersede the interest in cooperation between the two countries.
The grand bargain that you've talked about, the smaller issues that also might lead to that grand bargain, you've mentioned that a lot of people are gulping at some of these things, Brad, and that they're looking at it like this is an impossibility because of politics. But would there be something that would happen politically or otherwise that would, again, shift an already shifting carpet on which everyone is trying to stand and find a position?
Of course, external events could drive thinking and should and will certainly be contributing to thinking in Seoul and in Tokyo. The way I like to formulate it is it really becomes a question of, do the leaderships in Seoul and Tokyo want to think of themselves as great national leaders, or do they want to see themselves as world historical leaders? And my sense of Prime Minister Abe, at least, is that's certainly the way that he conceptualizes himself. He seeks to genuinely shift Japan's place in the world, to reestablish its claim and its credibility as what he calls a first-tier nation, a claim that has been essentially under assault for the last two decades because of what's called the lost decades, and that's a core component of Japanese identity. And, you know, the most immediate and striking parallel is the Nixon to China trip, that because he is precisely a conservative nationalist, that if anyone is going to deliver on a reconciliation of this nature, which really requires a hard look at Japan's imperial past and looking at the way that that Japan engaged and colonized South Korea, that he would be the person to do it. He would have credibility with constituencies that others would not in Japan, just as President Nixon did. And, you know, then the question becomes, to what degree are the South Koreans then going to be able to acknowledge that sort of gesture if he's really to make it? And then you have President Park, who's demonstrated, I think, a real skepticism, who, too, is a conservative, and therefore, actually, interestingly enough, it might be more interesting for a leftist to take that on, although a conservative, too, has a certain perspective on Japan that would make the, if you will, the stretching out of the hand to meet Japan would make that such a meaningful gesture. So it really becomes just a question of the degree to which the leadership in these countries is prepared to look beyond domestic politics narrowly defined and look at larger historical trends and where they want their country and themselves to be remembered.
And not too long from now, we're going to see the leadership in the United States change. As that variable is still unknown, you're obviously looking at calling on the United States to do this long term. What do you think might happen should we see a very different foreign policy, a very different view toward any sort of reconciliation act on our part to bring these countries together?
Scott, you're in the belly of the beast on that one.
Well, I think that there is a bipartisan element to or consensus about what the U.S. needs to be doing in Asia at this point, broadly speaking. I think that the idea of the rebalance has traction on both sides, and a lot of the quibbling is about whether or not it is feasible and whether or not it's resourced. So I think that that fundamental idea can go forward, and it's in the interest of the United States to try to facilitate a good relationship between Japan and South Korea, maybe particularly because of the emerging strategic challenge of a rising China. And so I think you can make an argument that a good Japan-South Korea relationship is essential either if you are preparing for a little bit more competitiveness or confrontation between the U.S. and China, or if you want to see a greater sense of cooperation or a facilitative relationship between the U.S. and China.
My sense with that is that you could look at it going really either way. I think that if in fact you look at China as being a threat, then the inclination will be to do whatever it takes to push, as Scott said, to get everybody on side. On the other hand, one could assume that if you buy that China threat thesis, then your inclination is to believe that alone should suffice to serve as the glue, and the Americans might not need to do this soft, squishy, touchy-feely identity stuff. And similarly, I would suggest that there is more so on the GOP, but I doubt it's certainly not a problem for the Democrats, is a greater reluctance to take on the questions of a historical reckoning, if you will, and there's a less of a tendency to question U.S. Behavior in the past. So that's a little bit of a problem. But in neither case, quite frankly, is it going to be easy, because there is this fear that the United States will be forced to take sides and will end up alienating one or the other. But I think Scott's formulation is quite a good one. And if we could, you know, the argument that we're making is that we should be using these concepts and we should be using these identities essentially as a way of communicating with these countries and to give them more and to articulate the way that we address these issues. That requires a little bit of creativity, but it can be done.
It's been a little over a month since the book was released. You have been traveling, and as everyone is listening to this conversation now, you are both traveling and in Asia. But talk a little bit about what some of the reactions have been and what may be possible or probable, what we might see of any of the things that you have suggested thus far. Scott, go ahead.
So we're right at the 50th anniversary of the Japan-South Korea relationship normalization. This is really a critical moment, I think, for Japan and South Korea to try to inch forward in the relationship. Likewise, we have August 15th coming up, and the South Korean side is going to be scrutinizing what Prime Minister Abe says in his speech on that particular date. The main argument that we've heard so far, I think, has been essentially that our vision is a kind of pipe dream, and our argument, in response to that, is basically, this is a path forward. It should be tested, and if what we propose proves to be infeasible, then the parties that are responsible for not allowing this to go forward will end up bearing the blame.
Scott, excuse me, when you say that the response you're getting is that it's a pipe dream, are you getting that from all parties or just certain parties?
Well, that's been a dominant response that we've seen. Well, so the South Korean side, I think, likes a lot of what we have to say, but I think they haven't studied carefully enough The fact that we're also saying that it means that South Korea is going to have to put its historical grievance completely behind it.
So
if
it's not,
Japan indeed does the things that we recommend.
So South Korea may like some of what you're talking about, but you think they haven't fully understood what will be asked of them?
That's, well, yeah, because basically it means giving up this sense of grievance. I mean, they've been holding on to this sense of grievance toward Japan for such a long time. It's deeply embedded in the Korean educational structure and emotional fabric. And so it's like, what would South Korea do if it didn't have, Japan to focus on as a kind of whipping boy? Because essentially what we're saying is that, you know, if Japan actually meets a lot of the demands that Korea has made with regard to showing sincerity about historical reconciliation, South Korea has to accept it. And what we often hear on the Japan side is, oh, well, even if we do all this, there's no way that South Korea will accept it. And so essentially we're saying, well, why don't you try it and see? And if indeed South Korea doesn't accept it, then everybody will know that the problem is on the South Korean side, whereas right now I think it's pretty fair to say that the dominant impression is that Japan's gestures and efforts toward historical reconciliation have remained incomplete.
We're coming down to the last part of the hour, and in listening to you describe that, it sounds at the macro level what many families go through on a daily basis. And forgiveness is really, really tough, even when you're talking about with one person, let alone with a country and with a deep, long, and stinging history. Going forward, is there something that you think that might be a turning point, might happen in the near-term future that wouldn't ask as much, but that would put them on the road to even one of the smaller things that you're asking in general, working toward a grand bargain?
The process is underway. I mean, we're seeing already an evolution in South Korea suggesting that maybe there needs to be a more pragmatic approach to the relationship with Japan. And so President Park is indicating that that's on underway. The 70th anniversary speech that Prime Minister Abe will give that commemorates the 70th years since the war was closed will be a very, very important statement. And my understanding is that there are discussions underway as well between those two governments to make sure they're on side. I think the key here, and you know, you used the word forgiveness, and I think that's really what this is so much about. Reconciliation here has to be shifted from a legal, political terrain, if you will, to a moral one. And that's so much of what's behind our argument, that we need to reframe this and get away from arguments about liabilities, et cetera, and start making grand gestures that are intended to transcend a very narrowly conceptualized political framework. To the degree that we can do that among all three countries, I think we have certainly an opportunity for success. A failure to do that might end up with some sort of, as we say, rapprochement, but nothing that will survive over time. It won't be durable. And that's the key here, is coming up with an enduring solution.
I want to thank both of you for spending the last hour with me, and safe travels to you as you're around talking more about the grand bargain that we've been talking about this hour. Bob Glosserman is the executive director of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu, and joining us by phone was Scott Snyder, senior fellow for Korea Studies and director of the program on U.S.-Korea policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you back in the studio next week live. In the meantime, have a good evening. Aloha.